From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 25th day of September 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo. He's at globalcomresearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. And a bit later in the program, we'll discuss the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions. Along the way, we'll take up the western corn rootworm. Right? That's not an insect pest you've thought about for a while because the GMOs or BT corn has taken care of that. The effectiveness is beginning to wear out. We'll discuss that with Nick Sider, University of Illinois Extension entomologist, on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
December corn on this Friday finished a penny and three quarters of a cent higher at $3.65 and a quarter. March for the day up one at $3.73 and a quarter, and May at $3.78 and three quarters a penny higher. Next year's December futures at $3.84 in Chicago, three quarters of a cent higher. November beans, new crop up 2.5 at $10.25. January at $10.06 and a quarter, three higher, and March at $10.01 and a quarter up four. May soybeans $9.99 and a half up four and three quarters, and next year's November soybean contract at $9.48 and a quarter up two. The bean oil 48 cents higher. The bean meal up $3.10 on the afternoon. Soft red winter wheat July down 5 cents at $5.56. The hard red July down 7.5 at $5 even. Live cattle futures in Chicago 45 cents lower at $107.57.5. The October feeder cattle down $1.95 at $140.32.5. And October lean hogs per 100 pounds at $71.75 up $2.27.5. Mike Zuzlo is now here from globalcomresearch.com. Mike, sure looks like it's going to be a great weekend here. How about where you are?
Yes, I believe we're going to break the 90 degree mark on Saturday at this stage. Todd, we are probably hitting the mid 80s right now as we go on the air. So it is going to be a nice warm weekend for harvest, and a lot of combines rolling around here, as I'm sure they are back in central, east central Illinois.
Well, so I was out for just a bit this morning, and there were combines running in our part of the world. You're going to have a really, we'll have a big swing in temperature too, but your swing in temperature is going to be really big by the time you get to the middle to the end of next week.
Yes, and we've had a big swing in basis, and it kind of is indicative of what the yields are looking like in the corn crop here. Beans have been pretty steadily weak, you know, 45, 50 under, not uncommon to see throughout the western corn belt and including Kansas and Nebraska. But the corn basis here in particular was very surprising to me. Just about a week, week and a half ago, it was still running 5 to 7 over for nearby and even all the way into early October delivery. But that has since swayed back into a pendulum swing of almost 50 under at this stage. So I have been getting very strong corn yield reports from the North Country as you head towards the Nebraska border, and I think that's indicative of what's happening here. I've also seen where we're getting basis reports and basis fluctuations in areas that are not so great, and that is both corn and beans. And talking to some clients near Jacksonville, Illinois, and Springfield, Illinois today and this week, would suggest that area maybe not getting the corn and bean yields that they had hoped for earlier. And there's still kind of a push at the at St. Louis and the Mississippi River, it sounds like. And that's probably something that maybe will be short-term live, but I think there is starting to be more of hard data coming in, and the elevators are compensating ahead of this grain stocks report by shifting the basis based upon what the yields have been.
What do you think the grain stocks report will show?
I'm not sure if we're going to get as bullish of a report as we need. I think we can get a friendly report, especially from the corn and from the soybeans, because of the test weight issue last year, probably needing to be addressed again in the corn market, or addressed finally in the corn market, and just the outright demand side of the equation for the beans. But I think what I mean by I'm not sure we can get a bullish enough report is that at the end of this week, probably the most important thing to take home with you is the idea that we have indeed seen, as more harvest data has been accrued, we've also seen an accompaniment of a dollar shift back to a safe haven bias. And we've seen some major shifts and structural changes in the Brazilian currency. The Russian ruble, I believe, hit a 22-week low here today on Friday at the end of the week, starting to really affect the wheat market. And I think most importantly for the soybean bull out there, Todd, we've seen that the Paranagua cash bean price, mainly because of the currencies, has gone from about $450, $460 a ton down to about $400 even. And it's actually now discounted both against U.S. Gulf beans and Pacific Northwest by about $20 a ton now, whereas we were carrying a discount of anywhere from $20 to $40 a ton. So I think the demand rationing has been done through the currencies. That may be something we have to live with all the way through into the election if this dollar becomes a safe haven.
Wait, so you're suggesting that the move that we've seen, I think this is what you're telling me, the move that we've seen in the soybeans is now going to be suppressed, I guess, because South American soybeans are cheaper again than U.S. soybeans. And that's based on just the currency itself.
Exactly right. We had about a 4% decline in soybeans for lead month futures this week. So we did see the U.S. bean price at the Mercantile Exchange go down, but yet we still have a premium now compared to the Brazilian price. And that's the deferred Brazilian price, but that's the best one we can look at because the September bid right now really is quite useless at this stage of the game. So I think this is where that was the heart and soul of the rally that we saw was the demand rationing mindset and the fact that the major competitor being Brazil was out of the market. So we still have a major drought in South America. We still don't know what the U.S. yields are, but we're getting good yield reports in and still fairly strong yield reports. So I think the market's very well balanced. And if the dollar continues to go higher, and it did look like it wanted to break above some key resistance levels as we closed out Friday, if we go higher into November, I think we're back to a market where we got to feed the bull with USDA supply demand weather data, more micro data to do that. So that's what I'm going into Wednesday's report looking at.
You think the USDA will give us that kind of data once they get to the World Agricultural Supply Demand Estimate, which of course will include the numbers that are produced next week in the grain stocks figures?
I think that we'll probably have to wait to the October WASDE report to get something really, really strong in terms of turning the market higher to either challenge or take out these recent highs we saw about a week ago today. So that my sense is that we have to get more acreage information and more yield information from USDA, and that the grain stocks report just simply won't provide that.
Who are the players in the marketplace at this point, and what are their heaviest bets?
Well, I think the funds probably have you know, they've been definitely players in the marketplace because some of the major commodity indexes, and it's been commodity indexes that have really been lighting up the market here in the last 3 to 4 weeks, in my opinion. And some of the major indices, if you track ETFs based upon those ag commodity indices, they have almost doubled their net long position in terms of value, the amount of billions of dollars that they've put into certain commodity index funds and ETFs. So I think they're very well situated for the inflation bug that the gold and silver started. And that too probably makes me think maybe we don't have as much new buying that can come into this market. And I would say also as we head into the election, and the way the ports are starting to get pretty stacked up at this point as far as the Gulf and Pacific Northwest, the cash side of the equation may be a little bit more difficult to add to their bids to buy in the short term, and we'll probably start to look in the deferreds for the better prices as far as bidding up from the commercial side. So I'm not trying to be too much of a bear, but I think that we got really bulled up on this last run up, and I really wanted the macro side to be on our side as we got into the harvest, especially given the election. That's why I stayed on the hedge side.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate it. You have a great weekend, man.
Thank you, sir. You bet.
That's Mike Zuzulo at globalcomresearch.com. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The Western corn rootworm has plagued farmers in the United States and their corn crop for decades. In the mid-1990s, it managed to do a cultural shift and adapted to the crop rotation that producers were using to control it. And then in the early 2000s, YieldGuard corn was introduced by Monsanto. It was genetically modified to protect corn from the Western corn rootworm. Nick Sider is an Extension field crop entomologist at the University of Illinois. At the time of the introduction of YieldGuard corn, he was an undergraduate student.
Actually, back when I was an undergraduate student, it was brand new technology. And so the first trait that was released was the YieldGuard trait, Cry3BB1. Several years after that, we had the Herculex trait, which was Cry3435AB1. There's two other individual proteins out there. They're the AgriSure trait, which is MCry3A, and the Duracade trait, which is ECry3.1AB. Now, three of those four traits have a similar mode of action. That's the YieldGuard, the AgriSure, and the Duracade trait. And 3435, the Herculex trait, has a slightly different mode of action. Now, in the years since, we've been developing resistance in the Western corn rootworm population in particular to these traits. And the first trait for us to find resistance in, of course, was the first trait that was released, Cry3BB1. In the years since, we've found resistance and, in fact, some cross resistance to the other three traits that have a similar mode of action. And in recent years, we've found resistance to 3435, to the Herculex trait. So we have resistance to each of those individual traits, sort of scattered throughout, especially the central and western corn belt. Resistance to 3BB1, as you might expect, in Illinois is becoming fairly fixed. Resistance to 3435 is a little spottier. It's not as complete, but it's developing. We've started to see a little higher numbers of adults coming out of SmartStax corn, particularly this last year, and even in some cases, a little more damage than we're used to seeing in SmartStax corn. We haven't had really outright failures of that technology this year that we picked up, but it is something that is concerning to us, is that we're seeing just higher numbers and a little bit more damage than what we're used to seeing. And none of this should surprise us. None of this should really, in fact, it doesn't surprise anyone who's been working on the technology. The way that Western corn rootworm and Northern corn rootworm as well overcome these traits, it's just a gradual loss of susceptibility over time. They're gradually, these populations are becoming more and more resistant to these over time. And this year, we've seen higher numbers in general than we have over the last couple of years in particular. We're still not up to what it used to be. As you mentioned, in the mid-90s, the early 2000s, the sorts of just incredible population numbers of corn rootworm, particularly Western corn rootworm, we're not there yet, right? And we're still getting a lot of efficacy out of these traits, but we are losing that efficacy over time. And it's something that we're very concerned with, you know, something that we're monitoring closely. And we want to make sure we do what we can to protect those traits and preserve them for as long as possible.
Which of the traits are in SmartStax?
SmartStax includes Cry3BB1, so the YieldGuard trait, and Cry3435AB1, the Herculex trait. So it's a combination of those two proteins.
Is there any good way to rotate around that? Because you have the two different modes of action in one package already?
There really is. In terms of rotating modes of action, with the BT, we really don't have a mechanism for doing that anymore. So the single trait packages have been phased out for resistance management purposes. And that's a good thing, actually. Those single trait packages are not holding up well. However, when you only have 4 BT traits and 3 of them share the same mode of action, you can see where the problem comes in terms of trying to rotate proteins. We don't really have a mechanism for doing that. Almost all of the packages contain 34, 35, and another one of the proteins, either 3BB1 or MCRY3A. We do have one, the Duracade package, that includes MCRY3A and ECRY3.1AB, but we do have cross-resistance within those proteins. We have cross-resistance to CRY3BB1. So when we take all those factors into consideration, rotating trait packages really isn't an effective tool for us right now in terms of resistance management.
What do you want farmers to do? How do you expect them to try to think about managing this?
Certainly in terms of monitoring the performance of these trait packages, I would recommend both watching the adult populations that are coming out of the different corn hybrids they're going, as well as digging up some roots, cleaning them off, and looking at how much pruning they have. Often we'll see lodging when we have heavy rootworm damage, but not always. And we can suffer a fair amount of damage below ground without seeing that lodging above ground. And so you really want to go out, dig up some roots, look at the pruning that you've got, and especially monitoring that over time is a great way to monitor your local population. One thing that's become clear, you know, in recent years, we can't count on a new trait being released every 2 or 3 years to help us solve this problem. You know, they're not necessarily going to be released at the schedule that we need to keep up with rootworm resistance if we're not able to delay it. And so that's what we really, it's critical to preserve these traits, not just to preserve their efficacy, but to protect the traits that are coming down the pipeline so that they're not compromised when they're released.
Nick Sider is an Illinois Extension field crops entomologist. He's located here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I was talking with him about the western corn rootworm and the BT resistance that the insect has been developing. On this Friday afternoon, we're joined by Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions in Agribull to talk about the weather forecast. Looks like it's going to be a pretty decent weekend. Let's start there, because I like good news and would love to be outside over the weekend. What do you see?
Yeah, well, the drier weather we've had for the last several days is going to continue. So we've got a few more days of that, including a bit of a warm-up as we go into our weekend. So, I don't see much change for us in the next 2 to 3 days, but there is big change that is on its way. And that's certainly going to be, I think, a bit disruptive next week in terms of continuing with our harvest progress.
What do you mean?
So it's a really cool story. Last Monday, we were watching a typhoon go over Japan. Its name was Dolphin. Now, normally, these typhoons happen all the time, and usually they don't have a big impact on us. But occasionally, they move north, and they get absorbed into the jet stream flow. Now, today, our jet stream is just screaming out of the west in the North Pacific, cutting into the Pacific Northwest. And when we have that kind of pattern, it's usually a bit more relaxed over us here in Illinois, which is why we got beautiful weather. Well, it's like we're going to snap the end of a long rope by letting Dolphin, that typhoon, start to push upward on the jet stream way over by Japan. Okay. At the same time that's occurring, the jet stream is going to take this piece of this flow that's coming out of, this is almost like the Arctic, cutting across Alaska. Long story short, we're going to dip a huge trough over the Gulf of Alaska. That's going to send the heat back west. That's going to send the fire danger back west. And over the Great Lakes, we're going to see the jet stream just take a nosedive into early next week. Now, all of that boiled down basically says enjoy the weekend, because next week we're going to be seeing some high temperatures Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday that could be in the range of upper 50s, lower 60s versus seeing these 80 degree temperatures this weekend. And with that, we do have a chance for some precipitation to come through as that whole deep trough develops. So what I'm trying to tell you is it's going to feel very much like fall very quickly here. And this also may bring with it like September 30th, October 1, 2, 3, we could start to see our chances increase for having those overnight lows get down into the 30s and maybe a frost somewhere around the Great Lakes. So I'm going to watch that carefully. But that was a mouthful to tell you, get ready for change.
Wow. So October is going to start out cold and potentially wet. Does that mean anything for the rest of the month?
It really doesn't. And then that's the tricky part, right? So when we think about things as they're shaping up for the month of October, the longer range guidance says, well, it looks as though this year, unlike 18 and 19, which you and I've been talking a lot about, looks as though it's going to go back over to a drier pattern. And possibly, even though we're going to start the month cool, maybe relax by the time we get, you know, into the second week of the month and warm back up a little bit again. And so I don't see anything at this point being a major disruptor to our harvest progress in October. And this is the first time in 2 years that you and I have been able to talk about not having major disruptors during harvest. So I still have a favorable outlook for the month.
You just became the farmer's new favorite meteorologist.
Right. I just hope I'm right.
Because if you're wrong, you won't be.
That's right.
The Black Sea area has had trouble all year long. Will that continue?
Well, yeah, the troubles, I just looked at a map showing the last 45 days of precipitation. So if you get into eastern Ukraine and the southern Russian wheat belt, there are some places in there that have between 0 and 15% of their normal rainfall. So this is an idea about wheat, right? So they need to get the winter wheat in the ground, let it germinate before we get into that October timeframe where things will be problematic with temperatures. And I don't see much of any kind of rainfall that would be considered good in the next 15 days. So that problem is going to continue there. And I think it's one that's worth watching, especially if you're keeping a close eye on global wheat markets.
Anything new on the La Nina?
Well, it just keeps getting stronger. We passed an important threshold this week where now the Central Pacific Ocean temperatures are averaging 1 degree Celsius below normal. So now we start to call this a moderate strength La Nina. And as a result of that, it's going to have implications as we go forward. Maybe first of all, going to be happening in South America. In fact, thinking about South America, you know, we're all waiting on the monsoon to return. And once it does, they'll start planting pretty aggressively. And it looks dry, though, for at least the next 10 days and possibly outward of the next 30 days. Where we need to start really talking about this being a big problem for soybeans and then the safrinha crop is if we're talking on October 15th through the 20th, that they're still not making major headway into planting that South American crop due to waiting on the monsoon, then there could be a reaction globally to that, and it could change things up for U.S. exports, and it could also change things up for how much we should expect to get out of Argentina, Brazil, especially southern Brazil is an area that I'm going to watch carefully. So, yeah, this La Nina could be the wild card for this upcoming growing season for them that may change things up.
Hey, we look forward to talking with you again next Friday. By then, I know you won't be their favorite meteorologist because it will be cold and wet, or at least will have been. And you'll have to remind producers that baby October will look better. We'll know more then. Hey, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions. Joined us here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.